Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, a leading climate scientist says the clock is running out on irreversible climate change. NASA climate scientist James Hansen joins us in our studios. He says the world has at most 10 years to alter the dangerous trends of global warming or face, for example, the melting of Arctic ice sheets, rapid sea level rise that will inundate coastal areas worldwide, mass species extermination, among other disasters. He says if we don't take significant steps to reduce our fossil fuel emissions, life on Earth will survive, but on a transformed planet, he says the world will be far more desolate than the one on which human civilization has flourished for thousands of years. We'll find out more. James Hansen is director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and my guest is here in Columbus. Yesterday, he delivered the annual Boniker Lecture sponsored by the Ohio State University School of Earth Sciences. Welcome to Open Line. Jim Hansen, good to have you here.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me.
And we're at 614-292-8513 if you have a question. You can also email your questions to openline@wosu.org. Well, Jimmy, say the clock is running out on irreversible climate change. This climate change is driven by human activity. So how drastic a change are we talking about if we don't take some measures?
Well, we're talking about potentially very large changes. And I know that's difficult for the public to recognize because weather fluctuations are so much larger than the magnitude of global warming that's occurred so far. And yet, we are getting close to dangerous tipping points. One of them we're beginning to see in the Arctic in just the last few years. The Arctic sea ice in the summer in 2007 was only about half as much a coverage as it had been 30 years earlier. And that's an example of the kind of rapid change that can occur due to positive feedbacks. As the ice melts, the ocean is darker, so it absorbs more sunlight, and that melts more ice. That's a potentially reversible effect, because if the planet would begin to cool off, then the sea ice would return. But there are other tipping points, like the ice sheets, which are practically irreversible. If we begin to melt, if an ice sheet begins to disintegrate, gets out of our control with large impacts on sea level, it would take tens of thousands of years to rebuild that ice sheet. So we don't want to pass that tipping point.
So if the ice sheets melt, this means inundation. The sea level will simply rise along coastal areas of the United States, in Europe, in Bangladesh could be simply flooded out of existence. What's the potential rise here?
Well, if we look at the Earth's history, we can see that when the Earth has become warmer by a couple of degrees, we've had sea level rises measured in meters or even tens of meters. That's what's possible this century, I think, is of the order of a few meters, which, you know, that would be disastrous. That would cover most of Florida and most of Bangladesh. So you're talking, you know, hundreds of millions of people who could be displaced by sea level rise. It's not going to happen in 1 year or 10 years, but it could happen over several decades. And once it begins and we let it go too far, it could get out of our control.
And we're seeing the possibility of a mass extinction of species. How would that happen?
Well, we can see the climate zones shifting. A given isotherm or temperature line, average temperature line averaged over several years, is moving poleward at a rate of about 50 to 60 kilometers per decade or 30 to 40 miles per decade. That's pushing species. Species can live within certain climatic zones. If the climate shifts, they will try to migrate to stay within their climatic zone. But some of them are less mobile than others, and humans have put barriers that inhibit migration, and there are natural barriers to migration. And we know from the Earth's history, when there have been large global warmings of 4 or 5 or 6 degrees, it has driven more than half of the species on the planet to extinction. And of course, other species came into being, but over hundreds of thousands of years. And that's why I say on any time scale that humans can think about, it would be a much more desolate planet if we drive species to extinction.
What happens under this warming scenario to farmland and climates for farming?
Well, we have already seen a shift in the expansion of the subtropics, on the average about 4 degrees of latitude. That's a couple of hundred miles. And it's beginning to affect the southern United States, the Mediterranean region, and in the southern hemisphere, Australia and South Africa and parts of South America, so that these regions have become, on the average, drier. And that's why Lake Mead and Lake Powell are now only about half full. There are going to be freshwater problems in these regions of the world where the subtropics is expanding.
So now, as I understand it, it's the consensus of the scientific community and those who study climate, those who study atmosphere, et cetera, a glaciologist and others who've studied the issue, that indeed the consensus, only a very few dissenters, that that indeed human activity, our production of global warming gases, is a significant feature here in moving the climate in this direction and the planet in this direction. So that we can take some steps, if we do it quickly enough, to mitigate this effect. Huh?
Yeah, that's right. If you look at the forces causing the warming are primarily increasing greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, and the primary source of those is fossil fuels. Now, oil is going to run out anyhow. We've used about half of the readily mineable oil. The real issue revolves around coal, because there are much more coal. And it also is the fossil fuel that we could do something about. If we're going to continue to use it, we should use it at power plants where we capture the carbon dioxide and sequester it. But so far, none of the plants are doing that. So I think we should have a moratorium on construction of any more coal-fired power plants unless and until we begin to use that technology.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about our use of oil products and burning them in cars, et cetera? I mean, how vast an effort? We're talking about a worldwide effort here, really, to reverse this, huh?
Well, we're going to need to find a means to power our vehicles other than oil, because that is going to run out, and we cannot follow a path of trying to squeeze oil out of tar shale or tar sands or coal, because that's a very energy-intensive process, and that would produce so much carbon dioxide that we would end up with a completely different planet. So we're going to have to find a method beyond fossil fuels to power our vehicles, and that's possible, electric vehicles or hydrogen-powered vehicles, but we're going to have to do that pretty soon.
You've said that this is a global effort, an international cooperative effort. Do you see nations stepping up to the plate here with the seriousness and with the intensity of change that you would like to see in terms of policy?
Well, it's not. They haven't matched the rhetoric. If you look carefully, although some countries are talking very green, they are not. They're still building coal-fired power plants. They don't yet get it that we're going to have to stop that. But, you know, it's often said, well, what's the use? Because China and India are starting to use more and more energy. But in many ways, they're actually thinking harder about this and making plans to go beyond fossil fuels. So I don't see them as being the problem. If we would begin to take the actions that are necessary, I think we can get the other countries to come along with us. But we have put most of the excess CO2 that's in the atmosphere now, so it's really our responsibility to take the first steps.
Mm-hmm. Well, what kind of thinking is China, for example, doing about this in terms of not putting additional coal-fired plants online?
Well, one thing they're doing is building a coal-fired power plant which will capture and sequester the CO2. The United States was talked about doing that. They spent 7 years deciding where they're going to build the first one, and then they canceled the plans. China, on the contrary, is actually going ahead with a project to build one. And they are also, they've contracted with the British architectural and engineering firm ARUP to build 5 carbon-free cities. It'll take a few decades to do that, but they're they're getting serious about the problem.
What is a carbon-free city?
Well, it's one which uses renewable energies to provide the energy rather than fossil fuels.
All right. And so in theory, then, there would be no greenhouse gas effluent or very little into the atmosphere.
With a net zero carbon emissions. So that's possible. You know, it requires making them more efficient, so you don't need as much energy. We could reduce energy consumption 50% and still have the same lifestyle. It just requires paying more attention to energy efficiency. Right now, our utilities make more money if they sell you more energy. Their profits are proportional to the energy that they sell. So they have no incentive to help us be more energy efficient. We need to change those rules. And a couple of states, two of the states in the U.S., have done that very effectively.
James Henson is director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, a leading climate scientist, and my guest is here in Columbus today because yesterday he delivered the annual Boniker Lecture sponsored by the Ohio State University School of Earth Sciences. We're at 614-292-8513. Emails to openline@wosu.org. Jim, is the public along with this consensus of the greater scientific community, or do you feel the public in the United States? I think it may be awfully difficult to convince people of things they can't see, feel, etc. And of course, there are propaganda forces on another side of this issue, which would lead people to think that this is still open to debate.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. There's a huge gap between what is understood by the relevant scientific community and what's known by the people who need to know, and that's the public and policymakers. It's actually become very clear that humans are now in control of long-term climate. That doesn't mean they're in control of the fluctuations that occur from day to day and from year to year, which are natural, chaotic fluctuations. But the average trends are now under the control of humans, and that is really not debated by the relevant scientific community.
Mm-hmm. There are a few scientific dissenters, one here on the Ohio State University campus, on the faculty here, and some of them seem, in fact, very sincere in saying, look, you know, your models are wrong, your math is wrong here, your analysis is wrong.
Yeah, those are people who've looked at it from some angle without the broad perspective that you need to understand the problem. If you want to understand the problem, you have to look at it not just from the standpoint of climate models. That's actually not the most important source of information. The Earth's history, the paleoclimate, is one of the major sources, but also the satellite observations of what's actually happening now in the Arctic, on the ice sheets. You have to combine this Earth's history, global observations, models that reproduce what's going on, and get a broad perspective of it, and then it becomes quite a clear picture.
Jim, you've written that the fossil fuel industries, you say, they hire scientific has-beens to dispute evidence and confuse the public. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's very analogous to what happened several decades ago when the tobacco manufacturers hired scientists to say, we don't think there is evidence that smoking causes lung cancer. It was a case when they knew better, and they, I think, acquired a legal liability. And in fact, they did then lose suits and had to try to partially reimburse people for the problems that they caused. Well, it's very analogous now. It's clear enough that fossil fuel companies understand the relationship between the emissions from fossil fuel burning and climate change. And it's very inappropriate for them to hire people to try to confuse the public. And I think they're assuming legal liability, and there are beginning to be suits against fossil fuel companies. The Alaskan village of Eskimos, where the village is falling into the Arctic Ocean because of the absence now of ice along the coastline, is suing ExxonMobil and Duke Energy and other fossil fuel suppliers and users. And I think that this will become clearer as the public sees what's happening.
Jim, I wonder what would be the basis for such a suit. In other words, if an energy company is supplying fossil fuels, petroleum, gasoline, whatever, oil for heating, and they're doing that, and they've got a buyer, and it's not illegal to sell this, what would be the basis for the suit?
There wouldn't have been a basis when it was inadvertent, when we didn't know that it was causing a problem. But once it becomes clear, and then once you try to mislead the public and you selectively hire those scientists who will dispute what has become a scientific consensus, then I think you've assumed some liability.
So the basis of the suit would not be simply that they sold these petroleum products.
Right.
Because that's legal and,
sure.
And we're all going to continue to use these petroleum products. You will, I will, you know. So the basis would be the misleading.
Right.
All right. Jim, you've also noted that this is not the first human-made atmospheric crisis. You take us back to 1974 and the chlorofluorocarbons. Tell us about that story.
Yeah, that was a great success story because when Roland and Molina realized that this human-made chemicals, chlorofluorocarbons, that those would dissociate in the stratosphere and release chlorine, and in turn the chlorine would destroy stratospheric ozone, that they published that paper, and the public responded very favorably. They, with the encouragement of environmental groups, they stopped making frivolous uses of chlorofluorocarbons in spray cans for deodorants and hairspray, replacing them with other alternatives. And then the Antarctic ozone hole was discovered, which confirmed that the theory was right and it was destroying ozone. So there was this Montreal Protocol in which the developed countries agreed to quickly phase out chlorofluorocarbons and to give the developing countries 10 years additional to phase them out and to give them technical assistance in doing that. And it worked. Now the ozone depletion has peaked and we expect it to decline over the next few decades because the chlorofluorocarbons are now beginning to decline.
But if there hadn't been this cooperative effort on the part of governments and the public manufacturers, et cetera, we would be in great trouble now?
We could have been, yes, because the ozone layer is essential for protecting life from ultraviolet radiation from the sun, which can cause skin cancer and other problems.
But we're not seeing the same kind of public awareness and cooperation now, or are we? I mean, you hear many people say, look, you know, I'm going to buy a hybrid vehicle, you know, I'm going to...
Well, it looked like we were, you know, when the problem was first came to the forefront in the 1980s, and rather quickly there was an agreement in 1991 or 1992, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, which the United States signed and essentially all other countries in the world agreed that we should stabilize atmospheric composition at a level that avoids dangerous human-made interference. And the Kyoto Protocol was then negotiated, but the United States and Australia refused to sign that. And so it was not very effective. Without the U.S. involved, it was not very effective. And the resistance is coming from fossil fuel industry, which is a very small fraction of the people in the country, but they're very powerful because they influence Congress and the administration.
Mm-hmm. James Hansen here from the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, 614-292-8513. Let's go to our phones. Bob is on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Fred. Very good show. Many of the things that I'm going to be referring to, you can find on the WOSU Open Line website and their discussion board called Global Temperatures Have Not Risen Since 1998. The one thing that I find interesting, and I'm one of those propagandists who don't buy into this, and the reason for it is because I've actually looked at the science, and you can see the science on the OSU website. But what's interesting about this science, or you want to call it science, is that temperatures peaked back in 1998. last year was one of the coldest years on record, and this year looks to be willing to almost ready to match it. Just recently, it was announced that atmospheric CO2 has been accelerating. Now, how they can reach a conclusion that CO2 drives temperature during a period of accelerating CO2 and temperature falls is beyond me. I mean, that's some kind of a science that I've never been exposed to. And the other thing is, if you look at Al Gore's charts, Al Gore's charts himself disprove his own theory, because what you'll see is that in the past, you see that, first of all, you see temperature lead CO2. Second of all previous peaks are above the current peak. And third, CO2 is at a level of 380 parts per million, way above the 280 peaks of the past. So you have all this historical evidence pointing that CO2 is not the to blame, and yet we're pushing this. If you take a look at the IR absorption spectrum of water vapor.
Well, hang on just a second, Bob, before we get so technical that we'll leave everybody behind. But let me give Jim a chance to answer you and have a short dialogue here. Jim?
Yeah, it would have been nice if you had come to one of my talks yesterday. For example, this is a common trick to point to 1998 as being the warmest year. Well, 1998 had the strongest El Nino of the century. It jumped two standard deviations above the trend line of the global temperature. If you look at the graph of global temperature, you'll see that although the global temperature fluctuates a lot from year to year, we've been on a steeply rising curve since the late 1970s. And now, 10 years after the 1998 peak, the trend line has got up to be where it was in 1998. So sure, if you want to selectively pick 1998 and say, oh, it's just as warm in 1998 as it is now, so warming must have stopped. Well, that's scientific nonsense, of course. If all you have to do is look at the graph and you see that that's nonsense.
Well, here's another trick for you. Let's take a look at your data, and let's take a look at 1934. Why don't you explain to me then why your data shows 1934 as the peak year relative to even 1998, and we had much lower CO2 back then? More importantly, can you point to me one single empirical experiment where you can show me a flask of air that holds 280 parts per million and 380 parts per million exposed to sunlight where there's a measurable temperature change? I've been looking and looking and looking, and I can't find even the most basic experimental evidence of what you're talking about.
Okay, again, you're jumping from one thing to another so fast that all you can do is confuse people. For one thing, you haven't bothered to say that when you're talking about the 1934 temperature, you're not talking about global temperature. You're talking about the temperature in an area that covers less than 2% of the world.
Wouldn't you agree that we're the most accurate temperature measures? And more importantly, CO2 is evenly divided all the way around the world. Why don't you explain why, if CO2 is a constant, why you would have temperature differences around the world,
well,
and why the U.S. wouldn't be a good proxy?
I think the reason that you don't understand things is you don't bother to listen. You just keep interrupting and bringing up a different point. One of the things that I point out is the reason why it is difficult for the people to see that things are changing is because global warming is small in comparison to the natural fluctuations, weather fluctuations. If the wind is blowing from the south as opposed to from the north, you make a difference of 10 or 20 degrees in the temperature. But global warming so far is 8/10 of a degree Celsius on global average, which is about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. And the fluctuations from region to region and from time to time are larger than that average change. And yet the average change is very important and has long-term effects. As we pointed out, the Arctic sea ice is melting. Glaciers are melting all around the world. The subtropics have expanded in their area by 4 degrees of latitude, and the coral reefs are being stressed by the increasing acidification of the ocean and the increasing ocean surface temperatures. There are many important effects that occur with global warming of only 1 or 2 degrees. And the problem is that although we've had 8-tenths of a degree Celsius global warming, there's more than that in the pipeline due to the fact that the climate system requires time to change in response to changes in the forcings, the changes in the atmospheric composition. So we've seen less than half of the equilibrium response to the gases we've already put in the atmosphere. And we, you're confusing weather and climate.
Okay, Bob, we must break, and I thank you for your call. James Hansen here, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies. We're talking about climate change, clearly, and we'll be back with my guest. And you call us after these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News. Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour, a leading climate scientist says the clock is running out on irreversible climate change. NASA climate scientist James Hansen joins us to say the world has at most 10 years to alter the dangerous trends of global warming, or if we don't, we face the melting of ice sheets, rapid sea level rise that will inundate coastal areas worldwide, mass species extermination, among other disasters. If we don't take significant steps to reduce our fossil fuel emissions, he says, life on Earth will survive, but on a transformed planet that will be far more desolate than the one on which human civilization has flourished for thousands of years. James Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard School for Space Studies. My guest is here in Columbus Day. Today, yesterday, he delivered the annual Boniker Lecture sponsored by the Ohio State University School of Earth Science, Sciences. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a question to openline at wosu.org. Jim, maybe we could take a moment here to go over the basic science again and explain. I always can use a refresher on this one. I know myself. How greenhouse gases that we generate from burning gasoline in our cars, from coal-fired powered plants, how they act to raise global temperatures in a way that will have these destructive impacts?
Yeah, it's pretty simple. The greenhouse gases are invisible. They're transparent to sunlight, so they have no effect on the amount of sunlight that's reaching the surface of the Earth. But they do have an effect on the heat radiation that's radiated back to space because they are partially opaque in the thermal infrared region, the region of heat radiation, the long wave radiation. So they make the atmosphere more opaque at these long wavelengths. So that means the radiation to space from the Earth originates at a higher level in the atmosphere, and the temperature falls off with height from the surface to the higher levels in the troposphere. That means if we make the atmosphere more opaque so the radiation absorbs from a higher level, it's less radiation going to space. And therefore, the planet will need to warm up in order to restore energy balance with space. If we have more energy coming in than going out, then the planet warms up. And eventually, it gets to a level where it restores this balance. That requires the temperature to go up.
Mm-hmm. And it is, in fact, these greenhouse gases that humans emit that scientists have discovered is providing the critical difference here.
Right. It's primarily from fossil fuel burning. We emit carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and methane and some other trace gases.
When people make individual efforts, you know, to reduce their consumption of greenhouse gases, you know, they walk a bit more, they bicycle a bit more, they may buy a hybrid automobile. I mean, is this futile in a sense? I mean, we do need more than that, don't we?
Yeah, it is futile in a certain sense. It is helpful, and we'll need to do things like that. We should be more energy efficient. But the truth is we're going to burn the oil. It's owned by Saudi Arabia and Russia. They're going to sell that oil, and it will end up in the atmosphere. And whether it goes there this year or next year doesn't matter that much because its lifetime there is centuries. So the important thing is to recognize where this is coming from and what we could do about it. And the largest source is coal. Now, that is something we can do something about. We can't capture the gases coming out of the tailpipe of a vehicle, but we could capture the CO2 at power plants. So if we're going to continue to use coal to generate electricity, we should be capturing the CO2.
Well, now, Jim, you've been speaking out as a member of the scientific community for many years about this, and the Bush administration tried to silence you. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, it's not just one administration. It's been a growing tendency over the last several decades for administrations to feel that they should control what any government agencies say to the public. So the public affairs offices in the different science agencies are now headed typically by political appointees. And they, in effect, are converting these public affairs offices to be offices of propaganda. It just doesn't make sense. A democracy cannot function well if the public is not well informed and honestly informed. And I think the public should be asking the candidates for presidency and for public office if they would agree to have public affairs offices staffed by professionals rather than political appointees who get changed as soon as the administration changes.
Propaganda now in favor of whom? And why would they convert scientific information into propaganda?
Well, global warming is a good example. That became a sensitive topic. So if a NASA scientist wanted to talk about stars or planets or something, there's no restriction on what they could say. But if they want to talk about global warming, you know, they had practice press conferences. One of my staff members was told at a press conference on the Arctic sea ice, where it was going to be reported that Arctic sea ice was decreasing rapidly, a reporter asked, well, is there anything we could do about it? And he said, well, we could reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And the political appointee jumped up and said, that's unacceptable. That's policy related, and scientists cannot speak on that. But all he was doing is connecting the dots so the public can understand why the sea ice is changing. And we should be allowed to give basic information to the public so they can, you know, make sensible decisions.
So this public affairs fellow who jumped up, did he make that statement because the administration fears or is in allied conjunction with some of the fossil fuel industries? Is that the problem?
Well, I would presume that it's related to that. But in any case, they have decided they want to control the information that the public gets about the science.
And is it still the case?
You know, it's certainly still the case. If you ask EPA scientists or National Institute of Health scientists, are they free to give the results of their research? Unfortunately, most of them say no. There are still political control over what they're allowed to say.
Mm-hmm. But you speak out.
Yeah. Well, I've had enough attention that I think that they've recognized that it would probably be more publicity that they don't want to have if they tried to silence me.
So you say this is not just the Bush administration. So was this kind of muzzling of scientists going on in the Clinton administration too?
Well, yeah. When an election occurs, those political appointees at the head of public affairs will be gone in a heartbeat. And I just think that those offices should be run by professional public affairs people, not mm-hmm. by political appointees.
So, but in the Clinton administration, then there were also political appointees, and they also tried to muzzle scientists as well.
As I've mentioned a number of times, I think the degree to which this is happening is much more extensive now than it was in current times. But it is true that in prior administrations, it was expected that public affairs would tend to give news that the current administration liked to hear. Mm-hmm. It's very unfortunate.
James Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, one of our leading climate scientists, joins us in our studio. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email a question to openline at wosu.org. Our next caller here is Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello. I'm thrilled that Mr. Hansen can be with us today. I've followed his work for some time and have great respect for his personal willingness to put his own career on the line for following up what he believes and what I too believe is a very significant issue. Let me start by saying that I'm absolutely a believer in man's impact on the climate. By profession, I'm a financial modeler, and I think that there is another side to this, though, in that I know from my own work that when you look at data that has small signal and large amounts of noise in it, that depending upon the time scale that you choose to look at it, you can see a variety of effects, some of them real and many of them not. It seems that clearly there are other sources of forcing on the global climate, things like solar irradiance. And I was wondering if Mr. Hansen could comment on how he evaluates some of these other alternative forms of forcing on the climate and how he feels they might stack up on a relative basis compared to man-made influences. I'll hang up and listen to your reply.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, he's absolutely right that you do need to try to look at the longest timescales you can because of fluctuations that occur on shorter timescales. The solar irradiance is a good example. It would be really nice if we had long-term measurements of how the sun has changed. We did begin measurements in the late 1970s, and over that time frame, we see that the sun does vary in brightness by about plus or minus a tenth of a percent. And we suspect that the variations are even larger on longer timescales, and that the Maunder minimum in a few centuries ago in the 1600s and 1700s when sunspots disappeared for a long time period, that the sun probably was dimmer at that time by perhaps a couple of tenths of a percent, and that may have contributed to the little ice age, the relative coolness at that time. There are other natural forcings like volcanoes. We had a very large one, 1991, Pinatubo, which put so much aerosols into the stratosphere, small particles, sulfuric acid droplets, that it reflected away sunlight, reducing the sunlight reaching the surface by about 2%. And that did cause a cooling, temporary cooling, for a couple of years of 3 or 4 tenths of a degree Celsius, which was in good agreement with what we had predicted as soon as that volcano went off and we realized how big it was. So there are various other factors besides human-made factors that do cause climate change. And you need to put together the best data you can get based on the history of the Earth. And now we're beginning to make instrumental measurements, especially from satellites. And as that record gets longer, we can understand the system better.
Mm-hmm. Jim, the human release of greenhouse gases by burning fossil fuels and their contribution to global warming being critical, as you say here. When scientists talk about this, with what degree of certainty do they say that that human response and that human activity is making the big difference here and must be reduced? I think I read a figure of something like 90%? Where are we?
Yeah, the IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that the United Nations set up, decided on a 90% confidence level. In my opinion, the confidence level is considerably higher than that. But that's a useful organization, which is an international organization. It requires agreement of all the parties, including countries like Saudi Arabia. So their stated level of confidence that humans are now affecting the climate is perhaps a conservative estimate.
Okay, let's go to our next caller here. Deep is on the line. Hi.
Hello. Yes. This is Peter.
Yes.
How are you doing today? I'm originally from Venezuela, and I hear a statement, you know, I know that Chavez is considered, you know, the evil spirit and all this. But, you know, in Venezuela that produces sometimes up to 5 million barrels of oil a day, they passed a regulation where everybody had to stop driving inside the metropolitan area one day a week. If your license plate started with a 1 or a 5, you had Mondays, 2 and 6, and Tuesdays, and so forth and so on. What they did by that, by the signature, by a national signature of the president, they saved 20% of the usage of gas automatically. On top of that, in Venezuela, do you know what the price of gasoline is in Venezuela right now? I just came back from there last month.
Tell us.
11 cents a gallon.
All right.
So they did that not only to save gas, but to save pollution and the keep the earth, you know. And if in a country like Venezuela, that is nothing, is, you know, third world country, call it whatever, that has a crazy guy for a president, Chavez, if they can do it there, why in this country, the Bush, Wolkowitz, Cheney gang, why can't they forget being oil people and look a little bit for the people, people?
Well, we have a question in terms of, I guess, the Bush administration. Jim, if you want to answer that one.
Yeah, I think it's what we need to recognize is that the fossil fuel supply, the reserves, are in fact limited. We've probably used half of the readily available oil. So we really should be thinking about how we're going to power our vehicles and our homes on the long run beyond fossil fuels, and why not try to get there a little bit sooner and save the planet in the process. I think, you know, it was perhaps natural for oil people to think the way to solve the problem is to drill for more oil, but it is a finite resource, and that's been proven. In the 1980s, President Reagan had been advised that there was lots more oil to be found in the United States if you just drilled more. And so people, they did encourage wildcat drillers. That increased by a factor of several, and they found very little oil. The oil is a finite resource, and we're probably near peak oil now. So we really should be working on the systems that we're going to have to use beyond fossil fuels.
Jim, are some of the oil companies diversifying in terms of their investments into solar, wind?
That's what they
wind?
Should be doing. They should become energy companies. And there's just an article in the paper in the last day or so where the Rockefellers are trying to encourage ExxonMobil to become an energy company instead of focusing entirely on oil. It makes sense. But as yet, most of the oil companies are not doing that because the profits to be made from oil are so large that they're just looking at the short term.
Okay. Next caller here is Julia. Hello, Julia.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to ask my question and then listen to you off the air. I want to know who determined what the correct average global temperature should be, how did they determine it, and what is that temperature, and how many times in our history have we been there?
Okay.
That's a really good question because that's at the heart of this United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It says we should avoid a dangerous level of global warming. But what is that dangerous level? Well, I've argued that we should look at the history of the Earth because there have been prior interglacial periods. We're now in what's called the Holocene. It's a warm interglacial period, and we've been in it for 10 to 12,000 years. But there were prior interglacial periods that were warmer than this one. And the but at most, they were about 1 degree warmer. So I had said, well, we had better keep additional warming less than about 1 degree Celsius, or we may begin to get into the region of the Pliocene 3 million years ago when it was a very different planet. Sea level was about 25 meters higher. So I think the Earth's history is our best guide as to how warm we could and plants and animals could survive well. But that is still a basic scientific question. And what I've realized recently is that, well, we've already warmed up by a significant fraction of what we can afford to do if we want to stay in that region of the other interglacial periods.
Mm-hmm. Next caller is George. Hello, George.
Hi. I just wanted to ask your guest, is it true that the majority of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere are the result of natural causes such as water vapor? And what he thinks of the theory that the greenhouse gases are the product of the warming cycle rather than a cause such as during a warming cycle, the evaporation process accelerates and you do have more water vapor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is true that the strongest greenhouse gas is water vapor, but the amount of water vapor is determined by the temperature of the atmosphere. As you know, in the summer, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere than in the winter because the temperature is higher. And so that's what's called a feedback. If we cause the planet to get warmer, then that will cause more water vapor to be in the atmosphere, which contributes to the warming. It amplifies the warming that you get from the basic forcings that you're applying.
Well, in other words, so water vapor is significant. But again, you say it's the human activity and the burning of fossil fuels that's tipping us over
right.
into a global average temperature that would
right.
be destructive to what we would like to preserve.
Right. Yeah. The amount of water vapor is a response to the other changes that are occurring.
Mm-hmm. Back to our callers, to Rod. Hello, Rod.
Yes. Good morning. I hope you can hear me.
Yeah.
Basically, what I was wondering is, are we looking at a potential energy crunch? Most of the power in this country is generated by coal. And, it just seems to me that, you're talking about hydrogen, possibly as an alternative fuel. The only way you can do that right now is by electrolyzing water, and that takes energy. So basically, you're just transferring, the emissions from the tailpipe to the smokestack, plus the fact right. that China's bringing coal plants on the online, very rapidly right now. So I'm wondering if we're looking at a potential energy crunch where we basically have the choice. We stop consuming energy, or we warm the planet up to a point where we, can't. Sustain it any longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right that hydrogen is just an energy carrier. You need energy to produce the hydrogen, so that does not help with our problem of getting energy to fuel our economy and our way of life. On the short term, we can do a lot with energy efficiency. So that's why I say we could have a moratorium on new coal-fired power plants if we just focused on energy efficiency plus renewable energies. And on the long run, renewable energies are going to need to be the basis for powering our society. And one of them, which is a good example, is called solar thermal. And that's where you use mirrors to concentrate the sunlight and heat liquid in pipes and then use that liquid to drive electric generation of power. There's a power plant being built in the Nevada desert that will supply power to California. There's enough solar energy in the Southwest U.S. deserts to provide the electrical energy for the United States if we would set up a low-loss electrical grid.
And Jim, let me ask you, is the technology available to do that right now?
The technology is now available. Mm-hmm. It's been developed particularly by a Spanish company, which used to be a U.S. company, but we kind of gave up on that in the 1980s. And now they've built a solar thermal plant in North Africa, which is transmitting energy to Spain on a cable under the Mediterranean Sea.
Hmm.
So the technologies are becoming available. We do need to encourage those technologies, and it's very unfortunate that this last Congress did not renew the renewable energy credits to encourage that technology development.
So this kind of solar technology, which is now available, and you say in the Southwest could provide all the electricity needs for the United States, on what scale would you have to what kind of acreage are we talking about? What kind of investment are we talking about?
It's a small fraction of the Southwest deserts. So it's technically possible, and I'm not sure that's going to be the primary source of renewable energy. But I think it's a good candidate. So it's an example that proves it can be done.
Sure. Scott, if you got a quick question, we have time for you. Hi.
Yes. On PBS, last year I heard a show about solar dimming, talking about where particulate pollution was actually dimming the amount of sunlight coming to the Earth and actually slowing down global warming more than you would have thought, given the fact of this pollution.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. The human fossil fuel burning produces small particles as well as greenhouse gases, and those particles do have a cooling effect. It's less than the warming effect of greenhouse gases, and that may be reduced if we clean up our atmosphere. So it's an important part of understanding the climate change.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Scott, thanks. We do have time for something. Whoops, that mark is gone, so that's about the end of the callers. Well, Jim, then, if we work together globally, not only in our private lives, but, of course, the government policies are the real necessity here, we can, do you believe, reverse this global warming sufficiently? Or is it going to have to be a matter, even if we act very quickly, of simply adapting to it?
Well, I think, you know, we really cannot adapt to disintegrating ice sheets and rising sea level. That would be disastrous. So we need to act quickly with regard to coal. If we would have a moratorium on coal and then phase it out by 2030, except where we capture the CO2, then the problem is solvable. CO2 would peak around 400 parts per million, and we could get it to decline by means of improved agricultural and forestry practices. So we store more carbon in the soils and in the forests. So it's solvable if we begin to act soon.
And it's a question then of national and international political will to do this.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. James Hansen, director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, thanks very much for taking the time to be with us this hour. Our thanks also to Amy Jervich at the controls, open line producer Linda Taylor, Renee Bamba on phones, and production assistant Elizabeth Wick. The news is next here on listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories heard today on WOSU comes from the law offices of Porter Wright Morrison Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.